Welcome back to the FKT Podcast. I'm your host, Heather Anderson. Today I'm joined by Mike Laurie, who set the men's unsupported FKT for running the Cape to Cape track across Australia in 14 and a half hours. Tune in to hear about his experience with a midwinter run across washed out beaches, waist-deep quicksand, and balancing periods of chronic fatigue with his longest ultra-length solo run. Mike, thank you so much for coming on the show today to chat about your Cape to Cape FKT.
Thank you very much for having me on. It's an honor to be on the podcast.
Yeah, I'm really glad you're able to make it. So before we get started on discussing this FKT, which is in Australia, something interesting that came up when I was doing research was that this Cape to Cape track FKT is also held by a woman named Christy Laurie. And then you mentioned in your email that your sister also does FKT. So you come from an FKT family. So I'd love it if you could talk a little bit about that, how you all ended up doing FKTs and maybe a little bit about that journey.
Yeah, sure. So my sister, Erica, not the one who holds the female FKT, she was the first one in our family to start trail running maybe 10 or 15 years ago. And I think in 2021, she decided to, there's a 1,000-kilometer trail called the Bibbulmun Track near Perth. And she decided to do that. And our whole family went and supported her. It was just over 10 days for the full 1,000Ks, 15, 20-hour days, most days, and a rolling crew with her. And it was just really fun. We made a cool little video about it. It got shown at some film festivals. And
oh, nice.
I don't know, it was just really, really good, like, sticking point for our family. And the rest of us have always loved to run. I myself am a professional triathlete as a background. And more recently, I've gotten into a lot more trail running. And my other sister, Christy, who holds the Cape to Cape FKT, she got into trail running around that same time as well. She's a mother of three and just loves it. So she snuck this one up. No one knew she was going to do it, the Cape to Cape. And even her coach didn't know. She was supposed to just run, you know, just go do it in like a 24 hours type thing, which is pretty popular to try and do. It's about the right distance that you can run, walk it in 24 hours. And then she ended up, we all supported her that day and carried her gear. And yeah, she just ended up flying through the day and getting the female record. And that was kind of inspiration for me to go out there and do it. I thought, oh man, if she's able to do it with a few kids and the amount of training that she does, then I should probably be able to do this with the amount of running that I do.
Right. Yeah. And so your sisters both did supported efforts, but you did unsupported. You didn't want your sisters to come help you out with your FKT?
Yeah, I got into trail running, well, partially through Erica's running, but I have a slightly different background. So I was a professional triathlete, and then I had chronic fatigue for a few years. So I couldn't do any running. I couldn't do any sport at all. But one of my favorite things to do is watch people hike on the PCT, actually. And so I got into fast packing. And so I do a lot of my own solo adventures. And then, yeah, I'm about to have a kid soon. So my wife's pregnant, and I just wanted to do one big solo adventure by myself. And yeah, that's how I ended up doing it unsupported.
Okay.
I also know that Cape region fairly well from a lot of camping and surfing along the coast. So I thought, I know where the water stops are. I know how to do this pretty efficiently. And I thought it should be a great challenge to get out and do.
I see. That makes sense. Have you and your siblings ever talked about doing a mixed gender FKT attempt all together? The whole family?
Yeah, we could. We did do a race. There's a race on the same Cape, and we did it in the team. We actually got the record as a mixed family because I'm actually one of five siblings. And
oh, wow.
We all do a bit of running. So yeah, we did it as a team. And yeah, so that was pretty fun. But I was thinking of getting Erica involved. She's the one who did the Bibbulmun track. Mm-hmm. But I was actually a little bit worried she might beat me and drop me at the end because she's pretty good at the longer running.
I see. Yeah, a little bit of a sibling rivalry there, maybe.
Yeah. She's no slouch at ultra running. So yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Maybe we'll pick something outside of Western Australia to go do.
So let's talk a little bit about the Cape to Cape track. So obviously, as you mentioned, it's in Western Australia. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about the trek itself? How long it is, where it's located? You said it's a really popular hike. So just paint a picture of what the trek itself is like.
Yeah. So Perth, for those who don't know, is in Western Australia. Western Australia is a huge state, and we have beautiful beaches. The middle of the state's got nothing in it, and the Cape is in the southwest portion of WA. I say the Cape, but it's actually two capes. The trail joins up Cape Lewin, which is in the far south of Western Australia, with Cape Naturalist, which is about 130 kilometers north. So the trail follows the coastline from Cape Leeuwin up to Cape Naturalist. It's about 180 miles. People typically will do it over a 6 or 7 day hike. There's campsites along the way. There's water barrels. It's a pretty popular tourist destination in the summer, particularly. But the southern section is more remote and defined by long sandy beaches. The first 25 kilometers is maybe 15 kilometers of sand mixed with some running up and down the headlands and some single track. So you start in the south. The first 25 kilometers is mainly beaches mixed with headland running and single track. And then you go into another 8 kilometer beach section followed by around 15 or 20 kilometers through some forests. We have some large trees that they're about 30 or 40 meters tall, and it's a pretty beautiful area to run through. But you mainly get to run on fire trail there, which is pretty awesome after running through long sandy beaches for a while.
I can imagine.
And then from there, going from south to north, the last 70 or 80 kilometers is single track across limestone cliffs and then down onto the beaches, on and off of lots of beaches. So I'm a rock hoppy on granite outcroppings, and yeah, it's pretty beautiful. It's really scenic. People come from around the world to surf there, and it's a great wine region. So yeah, it's got a bit of everything. It's West Australia's number one tourist destination, and it's just beautiful.
Yeah, it sounds really highly varied for being a coastal trail. It sounds like it has a lot of different aspects to it.
Yeah, so the vert is, funnily enough, not very much. It's maybe 2,500 to 3,000 meters of vert, depending on what your watch tells you. But I think the difficulty of the track comes in its technicality. It's constantly pretty technical. Nothing crazy, no scrambling, but there's always small rocks, single track for a good portion of the trail, and just lots of sand. The sand is the thickest sand you've ever seen.
Yeah. See, when you were like, it's 15 kilometers of sand, I was like, oh, that sounds so terrible.
Yeah. And it, like the time of year that I did it, the beaches were super washed out. So you're running at a, 15, 20 degree angle in this super thick sand, and you're just going nowhere.
Yeah. I feel like that would be such an exhausting start, but I guess if you went the other direction, it'd be a very exhausting finish to have that at the southern end.
Yeah, for sure. So
is northbound is the way most people go?
Yeah, most people go north, mainly because of the sand, but then also it's a bit more remote in the south, so even when you are supported, there's a lot less access points down there, unless you have a really sturdy four-wheel drive. The first 20 kilometers is pretty much inaccessible, and then from there you can start getting some regular supplies.
So since this is on and off beaches, is there any portion where you have to worry about tides, like timing it properly? You mentioned some headlands. Do the tides affect it at all, or is it far enough up that that's not a problem?
The tides affect it a little bit. We don't have huge tides in the southwest, so it's not a major factor, but it is a factor. Probably more of a factor is the time of year. I did it in July, and personally I would have preferred to do it in May or April. It just didn't work out with my training, but basically in July there's huge storms. And so it'll wash out the beach. So a beach that might be 40 or 50 meters wide in summer might only be a few meters wide in winter. And so you do end up in a situation where certain parts of the cave, you're running on really steep angles and there might not be any beach left. And you even have to go into the sand dunes for portions. I found out after the run that the local trail crew were wondering how the heck I got through some of the beach sections because there was no beach left.
You mentioned, you did it in July, and I was thinking when I was doing this research, that's pretty much winter in Australia. But it sounds like it was just a training thing, because I was like, why would you choose to do this in winter?
Yeah. I've just been really busy with work and life, and I was supposed to do it a few months earlier, but it just didn't work out that way.
Right.
It's not terrible in winter because the other trails are more compact from the rain. And so it makes the inland trails a lot nicer at that time of year, and it's cooler. But at the same time, the beaches are pretty terrible.
The beaches.
And then there's a lot of streams that don't flow in the summer, then flow in the winter. So you have to do a fair amount of stream crosses as well.
I see. And so is the weather predominantly rainy in that part of the world during winter? How cold does it get?
Yeah, it doesn't get super cold. Not in comparison to a North American winter.
Right.
We don't have any snow. It'll be It's still quite nice. It's maybe 15 to 20 degrees maximum Celsius.
Okay. I'm
trying to think what that is in Fahrenheit, like 60 or 70. Yeah, low 60s. And then it doesn't get below zero at night. So it's still pretty good.
Yeah, that's actually really ideal running weather.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Whereas the summer, when most people do the FKTs, it can be really hot.
Yeah, that makes sense. I do know it tends to be quite hot in Australia in the summer months. You mentioned there were some rain barrels. You mentioned streams that flow in the winter, but not in the summer. So can you talk a little bit about the water? Do you have to treat your water or is it potable? Were there water hazards? If there are streams flowing, were any of them difficult to cross? Water can make a big difference on a trail. So I'm curious how that affected your journey.
Yeah, so in summer, quite often the barrels can be empty. So they're usually associated with the track huts that people hike to, as well as there's just some toilet blocks along the way that you can stop in at in different, I want to call them small towns, but they're just areas where people have houses, like holiday houses. So a mixture of those, most of them are spaced about 10 to 15 kilometers apart between water sources. So it's actually not terribly long carries when you're running. The first carry is about 25 kilometers. So I carried about 2 liters and that was my maximum capacity for the day. And then from there, I think most of them were between 10 and 15 kilometer water carries. Most of them were non-potable sources, but I chose not to treat it because I figured it'd be pretty fresh and it wasn't a multi-day event. So I figured by the time I got to the finish, I wouldn't know whether I was going to be sick or not.
The whole, if I get sick, I'll be at home when I do.
Exactly. I mean, you might have more experience than that. I don't know how long it takes, but I've never fallen sick off these particular water sources yet. So I was okay with that. And then the stream flowing was a bit of a surprise to me. So halfway, you crossed the Margaret River mouth the day before, and it was still just a sandbar and a river on one side and the ocean on the other, but some pretty big overnight swells mixed with, I think some surfers had dug out a channel that morning. So suddenly it was quite a large river mouth with lots of water and lots of skim boarders and boogie boarders catching the river into the waves there. And so I took my shoes off and it looked like it was about ankle deep water, but the sand was all emulsified from running pretty quickly, from the water running pretty quickly. And I ended up sinking in the sand down to about my waist. And
oh my God.
Yeah. And this is at a fairly low point for me. I was in Strungletown at this stage, which is quite early. And I just, I'm really confident around the water. I've surfed my whole life down there, but I was a bit shocked and almost got stuck there.
How do you get out when you're in waist deep, basically like quicksand?
Oh yeah, I just started moving my feet as quick as I could. There were some skimboarders standing there and they were just young guys and they looked like they might have to come save me. They were kind of laughing and then they stopped laughing after a little while.
They realized, oh, maybe this is a little serious.
Yeah, this is a little serious. But in the end, I just powered across and it kept going down to waist deep. And I was like, oh, well, at least it's not too wide. Wow. Yeah, and luckily I'd taken my shoes off just before then. So I was holding those above my head and I quickly grabbed all my electronics and I had to like pull that above my head and walk across the river mouth. And then from there, I took a few hundred meter walk. Just barefoot, did a bit of barefoot running. And like I said, that was coming after a pretty big low point. So I just sat down, had a bunch of chocolate and candy.
Chocolate solves everything.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And some salt and vinegar chips. And I was just like, oh God, okay, we've got to reassess this thing.
Right. And this was pretty early on, right?
This is about bang on halfway. So about 65 kilometers in.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, that's probably better than it happening right off the bat.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. Yeah.
So can you talk a little bit about the low point that had just preceded that? What was going on?
Yeah. So I've only ever really done up to about 60 or 70 kilometers at a time, mainly fast packing, sometimes just going out and doing my own adventures. But doing anything beyond that, I knew it was going to be a bit of a struggle for me. I'm used to running pretty quickly. And so I knew I'd probably go out too fast. So the whole run was designed around me going out too fast and then struggling in the second half.
Hey, you know yourself. That's good. That's the first step.
Yeah, yeah. But I started struggling earlier than I expected. I started struggling around 50 kilometers in. I'd just come off some really nice forest section, really nice four-wheel drive trails. And then I got into some quite technical single tracks and some sandy sections. And I just couldn't eat any more food. I was told by other ultra runners that I might feel like that around 40 or 50 Ks in, you got to keep pushing. I was just going what I thought way too deep, way too early. And that combined with the lack of calorie intake was really making me struggle between 55 and 60 kilometers. And I was really questioning if I was going to make it the whole way, given
right.
I wasn't even halfway.
That's a long ways to go without eating.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So after the single trail, you go onto the beach for a fair bit and then up and over a huge headland. So this is just before the 65 kilometer mark where the Murray River mouth is. And I just sat down on a bench for a little bit, took in some calories that I could. And then it's a nice 4 or 5 kilometer run down to the river mouth. And so I kind of enjoyed that section. You get a kilometer on some actual road, which is really nice. And then you have to fill up just before you cross the river mouth of water, because the next section, I think, is 15 kilometer water carry. I got there and I was a bit hopeful that things would turn around.
And then you're waist deep in sand.
Exactly. Yeah, I was waist deep in sand and I was having some pretty negative emotions then. I ran up and there's a couple hundred meters you have to run along the beach after the river mouth. And so I ran along that just barefoot, which felt quite nice. And then for the first time all day, I just sat down. I opened my pack up. I took everything out to see what calories I had left. And I just ate anything that was solid. So pretty much just a bunch of chocolate bars and salt and vinegar chips. And then I had a 5-minute dirt nap.
I was wondering if you slept at all on this.
Yeah, just a 5-minute lie down. Didn't fall asleep. But I just needed to kind of reset my mind and emotions and hopefully start feeling a little better. Everything was just hurting at that stage. And I thought this is way earlier than I expected.
Right. So after you eat a bunch of calories and take a little rest, did you get back up from that and then feel like, okay, everything's good, I'm reset, I'm ready to go? Or did it take some more time to work your way through that? Or maybe you didn't work your way through it. How did it unfold there the second half?
Yeah, I just told myself, you got to keep shuffling. And it could turn around. Everyone said you're going to go through my sisters in particular said you're going to go through some low points and you've just got to ride them out and see what happens. And I slowly started feeling better. So the next section is go along the coast again for a couple of kilometers. And there's a few fun little rock hopping sections mixed with some beach sand that's a bit more solid. And for the first time all day, I had some footprints to step in. A guy with some Vibram soles, and it was the most glorious footsteps to run in all day. And from there, I just started rolling through. I felt good. I was moving a lot slower in the first half, but at least I was still moving. And I just accepted that the rest of the day was going to be a nice shuffle at like 7 or 8 minute kilometer pace. And I was okay with that.
I mean, that's good advice for life, but also especially FKT, as you know, at some point you're going to have some pretty low spots and you just got to keep going.
Yeah. So I probably had from 65 kilometers 75, I started feeling a bit better. There was a bit more fire trail around 75 Ks. And then from 75 through 100, I actually felt reasonably good again. My legs are starting to get tired, but I think having some of those chocolates and having some more solid calories really helped. And there was just some beautiful sections coming up where you're on and off, you're just running along the top of kind of a cliff sections. That's just beautiful running. I really enjoy that section of flowy single track. And then around 100 kilometers in, I hit kind of a wall and pretty much rode that out until the end.
In between, right after the river and when you hit that wall again, were you able to actually eat during that time? Did you get your appetite back or did you struggle with that through the whole rest of the run?
A little bit. My main form of nutrition was precision, gels and electrolyte. And I think that works really well for a little while, and then in my stomach it just didn't feel good. But I had some other type of gels which were more natural, some of the spring energy gels. Once I started feeling bad, I started having a few of those and they went down a lot easier. I couldn't take in as many calories. I was probably started out around 80 to 90 grams of carbs per hour, and then I think from there it probably dropped to 40 50 grams of carbs per hour for the rest of the day. But at least I was getting something in and it just allowed me to keep moving.
Yeah, you don't need quite as much when you slow down.
Yeah, exactly. Hopefully burning a bit more fat.
Yeah, exactly. So we've talked about this being a pretty popular backpacking, and you said there were some footprints to follow and that there were boogie boarders at the river. Did you see a lot of people over the course of this, or was it just concentrated at the river? How many people are out in the winter on this trail?
Yeah, so I was actually quite surprised. I expected to see a number of hikers because it being a cooler time of year, it's quite nice to hike in Australia, but I didn't see anyone for the first 50 kilometers, which was quite a long way to go without seeing a single other person. And then from there, it was mainly at the access points where people can drive in. Then I saw people, a few four-wheel drivers. There's a few small towns along the way as well. And so that's where the Murray River mouth is a super popular surf spot. And so I expected to see people in those locations. But yeah, it was mainly surfers. I saw a lot of surfers out and a lot of four-wheel drivers, and that's about it. There was maybe 5 or 10 hikers across the day. As you get further north, the beaches are a bit more populated. And so just regular beach goers. Yeah, at the end of the day, I had a funny interaction. I was totally wrecked, and at nighttime had come back, and there were some campers at the front about 10 kilometers from the northern terminus. They just saw a headlight coming out of nowhere, and I just kept running through. So they just see this headlight passing by, and they're like, and I just wave at them, put head down, like a quick wave, and they're just like, all right, have a good one, mate.
Did you wake them up, or had they been asleep?
I think they were around a fire, so I don't think so. I think they're expecting me to come into our campsite, and they're expecting someone to stop in and say hey and have a quick chat. I think they were kind of expecting that, and they were like, all right, catch you later.
Yeah, it's like, all right, whatever your deal is.
Exactly.
I'm sure at that point you were definitely not in the mood to talk to anybody.
No, exactly. I wasn't slowing down. I was in the biggest struggle of my life at that stage.
Ready to be done.
Pretty much. Yeah. The only other time I had an interaction with the hikers is those, the first two hikers I saw after 50 kilometers alone, they actually started clapping, which was a bit weird because I told no one I was doing this event and they were just clapping for some random runner on the trail. And I thought, oh, this is great.
They were very encouraging.
Yeah, I was like, this is so nice. I love hikers.
And so did you have anybody that knew what you were doing, like family or friends, at the end to clap for you as you came into the finish, or were you just all by yourself in the dark?
Yeah. Because I didn't tell many people until the last week, really. I just had my parents who dropped me off and picked me up. So they were there at the finish. And during my sister Erica's FKT, one of our things is yelling like a cooey when someone's getting close. And I did have a tracker, so they knew I was getting close. And so about 500 meters to the finish, I just hear this loud, like, cooey. And I was like, yes, nearly done. I cannot wait to be done.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, they were at the finish and my wife showed up and surprised me, which is really nice.
Awesome.
Yeah.
That's great. Too bad those, you know, random hikers weren't there too.
I know. Yeah. They were the most excited people I saw all day. Most other people just looked at me like,
I love that they were just, they didn't even know what you were doing, but they were happy you were doing it. So aside from people, did you see any wildlife? Is there much wildlife along the coast here, or is it too populated for that?
No, I expected to see lots of snakes and probably usually kangaroos and maybe some whales or dolphins running that far along the coast. Typically you'd see that in a day, but I didn't see any snakes, which I was very surprised with. Usually there's a lot of them around there and they're pretty dangerous, so you watch out for those pretty much all day.
I've never been to Australia, but just from what I hear, I just assume that you will see dangerous snakes everywhere you go. The way people make it sound. So okay, so no snakes.
In WA, that's probably not a bad assumption. That's good. Usually you do. Yeah.
Did you see any other wildlife?
I did not see much at all. I think I saw a few wallabies earlier on in the day, which is basically a small kangaroo. And that was pretty cool. I thought I saw a whale at one stage and I was like, this is totally awesome. And then it ended up just being a surfer and I was pretty disappointed. So yeah,
right.
I was hoping to see whales because if you look at some of the past FKTs, some of those guys I ran with a bit and they saw so much wildlife. So maybe I was just too in the box to see anything all day.
Yeah, sometimes that happens.
Yeah.
Also, I feel like sometimes whales can be hard to spot depending on waves and the angle of the sunlight.
Yeah, that's true.
Sometimes they're harder to see.
It's very true, yeah.
So how was the navigation on this? Is it a well-marked trail? Did you need to have maps or GPS to navigate with, or is it pretty straightforward?
It's fairly well-marked, but there's a lot of smaller trails that come off it and four-wheel drive tracks through the area that you run. And so you can quite easily go off track. A lot of other runners have, pretty much everyone who's done the full trail in a day has gone off, and most hikers will go off at some stage. But I grew up in there, going down to that area and running down there. And I like to think I know the trail fairly well. My sister, I helped her with some navigation as well. So I didn't actually go off trail the entire time. It is somewhat well marked, but there are some very confusing sections, especially in the smaller town areas. I know the previous FKT holder, Shane, he went off track for about 25 or 30 minutes because one of his paces is like,
oh,
this
no.
is the way, let's go up here. And he ended up having to run up a sand hill for 20 minutes and then back down it. So, yeah.
Oh, no. Yeah, that's awful.
I planned pretty hard and I did use my GPS. I struggled in the dark in the morning. There's a section which in summer you can run along the beach, but in winter you have to run along the top of a small cliff, small little, and you actually have to do a little extra section. And finding that marker is really difficult because it's not particularly well marked. And so you can't use your headlamp to get a good marker. You know how you can see the little triangle markers in the distance. So that was a pretty tough section. But the rest of it, I actually, yeah, follow along pretty well, just using GPS mm-hmm. on my watch.
It's amazing to me sometimes. I've been on trails that I've been on many times, and things that you think are really well marked when you're on them in the day, and then you try to go at night, and you realize these are not well marked at all, at least for being out here in the dark, because nobody marking trails is intending for somebody to be out there in the dark. And then when you try to do it in the dark, you're like, oh, actually, really hard.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. Well, actually, the start's the hardest part as well. So for that reason, no one expects you to do the start in the dark. It is mainly rocky headlands. You're rock hopping for 2 or 3 kilometers and on and off like these little small beach sections. And this time of year, it's pretty difficult to get across some of these sections with the how high the water is and how small the beaches are. And lots of the posts are just washed away from the huge waves. So you can't actually mm-hmm. see exactly where you're supposed to be going. You're like, ah, well, this looks like the right direction. And hopefully I'll link up with the track in a bit because there's no trail. So, yeah.
Right. So what would you do differently if you were going to go out and attempt this again?
I think I would change the time of year to a bit earlier. Try and do it when the beaches are a bit longer. And I would probably get more rest as well. I was pretty tired going into this one. Legs are in good shape, but yeah, just really busy in life. So maybe take a week break before and then knock it out. And honestly, I would do it supported. I think it's quite a bit more fun to do it supported. I'd probably have my friends and family around and some great footsteps to follow in the sandy sections and some good motivation and some good food.
Yeah, stuff that you would want to eat.
Exactly. Yeah, doing my first long ultra by myself, I think, was probably a bit of a bold move in the end.
I mean, there's something to be said for that, though. Jumping in with both feet, be like, I'm going to see how this goes. So what do you think was your takeaway from doing that? Taking your first big ultra attempt and doing it solo, and were you happy with how that went? Did you learn anything about yourself along the way?
I really struggled with the mental and physical side of things. I've had chronic fatigue in the past, and I've always been pretty strong-minded and strong-willed, and I feel like I can do anything. And so in planning, I thought, oh yeah, this is going to be great. It's not going to be super hard. I think I can do this. Not easily, but I think I can do it quite well. And I didn't realize how much of a toll it was going to take on my body and mind towards the end. So I was actually a bit worried that I might end up in another chronic fatigue state after it going so hard.
Yeah.
I think in the future, pacing myself would be a good thing. Sorry, back to the takeaways, enjoying the process, just enjoying being out there a little bit more. I think because I was in such struggled, like I struggled so much towards the end, I didn't really get to enjoy the trail as much. And maybe just going 15 or 20 minutes slower, really enjoying it, probably would have been, yeah, a good thing.
When you're looking at it on paper, there's so many things I've planned out on paper and I'm like, oh yeah, this isn't going to be too bad. And then I get out there, I'm like, this was a terrible idea.
Yeah. Well, I'm lucky. My terrible ideas are only a day long and yours seem to be a lot longer than that. So
that's part of what makes them so terrible. It's like, why did I think that this was a good idea to do this for so long?
Oh man, that'd be brutal.
Well, thank you very much for coming on the show today and sharing about this. It was really cool to hear about your trek and your experiences out there.
Oh, thank you very much for having me on. Yeah, I love listening to the podcast and yeah, really appreciate it.
Thanks again, Mike, for coming on the show. You can read about his FKT on the website, fastestknowntime.com, and follow his adventures on Instagram at MJLaurie.